You're listening to the Stone Tapes on Siren 107.3 FM with Sam Stone and friends. For the first time ever from the Stephen Langton building at the University of Lincoln, you're listening to the Stone Tapes Live with Sam Stone and friends.
Thank you to our producer, Alex. Welcome, everybody, to the Stone Tapes Live, which is the first time ever, as Alex said. And I'm delighted to introduce the gang to you today, because with us, as always, we have the amazing Patricia H. Ash.
Hello. Mm. Oh, I get a flag too. That's great.
We have the superb George Mann.
Hello.
David J. Howe.
A very good evening to you.
And leaving his castle over in Carnarvon, Robin Pearce, actually live in the studio with us today.
Hi, guys.
And I'm super delighted to introduce the amazing Daphne Ashbrook, all the way from Hollywood.
Aww, thank you.
But first of all, we're over to Patricia's Corner. What have you been reading this week?
This week I've been reading Warm Bodies by Isaac Marion. You might have heard of it. It's about a zombie and a girl, and they fall in love. It's sort of like Romeo and Juliet, except they're zombies and it has a happy ending.
Wow.
Yeah,
Zombie and Juliet.
Yes. Well, actually, it's R and Juliet. So this zombie...
Is he a pirate?
No, he just can't remember his name.
Doing pirates later, sorry.
He remembers that his name starts with R, and that's about all he remembers from being a person, and he's like, looking for life.
The rest of his name.
And he's, he wants to feel not dead. So then he meets this girl. There are brains eating involved. And this girl is a live human person. And he falls for her. And he sort of takes her home to the zombie hive, which is in an airport. He lives in a little airplane where he collects things like records. He is a hopeless romantic, and it is so sweet. Well, it's Romeo and Juliet, basically, except fewer people die, more people die. More people with no names die, and fewer people that have names die.
And more people would die before it started.
More people are... Oh, wait. Okay, that's confusing. But it took me 127 pages in a balcony scene before I figured, oh, ha, duh, his name is R, her name is Julie. It's Romeo and Juliet. His best friend is named M. Totally not Mercutio. It's really a really good movie. It's a good book, and it's also a movie, which is also very good, but in a different way. Sam and David and I...
All five of us.
Yes, five of us. And the cat saw the movie Warm Bodies last night, and gosh, there's some amazing performances in there, especially Nicholas Holt, who plays R, the zombie. He can't really speak very well, the zombie, so... There's a lot going on in his face and his eyes. Oh, my goodness.
It is a really
super
star performance.
Of that
really
movie.
Huge
It's a great film,
love
isn't it?
Love it.
Yeah. If you love the film, you'll love the book. They're different. There's more humor in the film and a little more philosophy in the book. It's difficult to translate a work that is told first person where a lot of the action happens inside somebody's head. It's difficult to translate that into a movie, and I think they've done it really, really well. So I would give both those 10 out of 10.
I think I'm... Well, I haven't read the book, which is on my definite to-do list now. Definitely is on my to-do list.
All right.
And I love the film, and I would agree with you on the 10 out of 10 with that.
Oh, I think the performances on that are wonderful.
They were award-winning, but they didn't get any awards that I know of.
Well, of course not. It's science fiction.
It's okay. I'm sure it's got a cult following now.
It should.
If it doesn't, it should.
It should.
What about you, George? Have you seen it?
No, I'm not aware of the book or the film, so it's going to...
Highly recommend both. I mean, I think Warm Bodies ought to be studied in school alongside Romeo and Juliet.
I agree.
Yeah.
I think the kids would like it a lot better than Romeo and Juliet, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
As you said, Nicholas Holt is absolutely awesome as R. As you mentioned last night when we were watching it, it's the expression he gets in his eyes, because he can't talk very much, but he's got the most expressive eyes, and you were constantly saying that when we were watching the film.
Is he the guy who plays the Beast in the X-Men?
Yes,
absolutely.
He is.
Yeah,
he's working
him.
With prosthetics there, isn't he?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes, of course.
So he's probably,
He's quite good at that. He should play aliens and things like that.
people
very,
in prosthetics.
Very good in those.
I think the thing I'm always impressed with people who play zombies is the physical performance as well as the, you know, in this case, you are seeing an awful lot of emotion in his face and eyes. But the body, his body goes from being, as he slowly becomes more humanized, from being really shuffly to actually becoming more human, doesn't it? Slowly changes. That's, it's really well done.
Who directed that movie? Does anyone know?
I don't know.
I looked this up last night, but I forgot it.
Yeah, sorry, we've forgotten. People will Google us with information. But
I'm sure.
They'll be calling you.
Yeah.
And so for now, we're going to go and have a listen to a song sung by our guest here, Daphne Ashbrook, and it's Too Late.
So easy living. bright and breezy, and I knew just what to do. Now you look so unhappy, and I feel like a fool. And it's too late, baby, now it's too late, though we really did try to make it. Something inside is dying, and I can't hide, and I just can't fake it. Oh, no, 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 no.
Absolutely awesome, Daphne. I'm going to pass you over to the wonderful Robin now, who wants to ask you a few very personal questions.
Well, the song may be It's Too Late, but it's never too late to talk to Daphne Ashbrook, is it really?
Nicely done.
Especially when I want to talk to you mainly about a film whose tagline was, It's About Time.
Okay.
Now, what happened was Doctor Who had gone missing from our screens for years. And then there was a back and forth whether Universal, NBC were going to make a film, BBC had maybe not relinquished the rights, and all of a sudden, Doctor Who was back on our screens for one TV movie only. And the first time ever, they moved the production to the USA, and you were the companion.
Yes, I was. Controversial, I think. I think that the Americanism or the American piece of it, I think, was kind of a dangerous thing to do. I think it did affect certain fans, but I think in the end, what they were being asked to do, and I certainly didn't have any of that power. I was just the hired gun. But they were being asked to introduce this long-running historic series to an audience that had not really, in general,
been aware of it at all.
Well, and Doctor Who was on public television, PBS broadcasting or something beforehand? So
yes, there was.
How much of it did you know before you went into the series? I mean, did you know it was like a rich sort of like 30-year history and that you'd be part of it forever?
No, I didn't know anything about it when I first went in and auditioned. I just read the script and thought it was really clever, and I loved the regeneration part of it. Eventually, I learned that Paul McGann was going to be in it, and I was a fan of his. I was into Withnell and I, and I thought that was brilliant. I thought he was lovely in that, and so I was very excited about working with him. And I had met the producers and the writer and the director, Jeffrey Sachs, and I really liked the way they were in the room, which, you know, matters in the end. And I auditioned in the States, so I hadn't met Paul yet. And it was just another job, really. I thought it was a really cool script, and I do like sci-fi. That's been there most of my life. So And I really liked the character. I thought it was a really well-written character. She was strong and funny. Lots of funny repartee with the lead guy. And I figured if I was lucky enough to get the job and work with a guy who was a generous actor, which isn't always the case, but he was very generous in the end. And we worked well together, and we just hit it off. So it, I think, contributed to a really excellent a relationship between the two of us. So I think in the end, it was a nice little bridge between the end and the old series and the new series.
As a Hollywood actress, what was your first impression of a script that involved a time traveling shapeshifter who traveled around in a phone box?
Well, I've always been all about, you know, using the imagination. I think that's one of the more powerful tools we have as actors, creators of any kind, really. And so I was all about it. I thought it was great. And like I said, the regeneration part was really cool to me. I automatically saw, just from having read the script, that it was. I could see why it might have the long-standing fandom that it does have. But I still didn't understand all of that. I don't think I understood that until the 50th anniversary. When I was sitting in the room looking at all these brilliant actors, I think every living companion was in that room. And I know their work from other things. I didn't necessarily see them on Doctor Who, but I knew their work from many other projects that they'd worked on, and I was humbled. And it brought a tear to my eye, and I wasn't the only one, too. I wasn't the only one that needed a tissue. It was a brilliant moment, and that's when I think I really understood the hold this thing has and the importance that it has to such a large group of fans. And I got to say, I've also seen the growth of the fandom. I hate to use that word over and over, but in America, because when I did it, There were people that loved it, Americans that did love that so much. But on the whole, nobody knew what it was. And now it's all the rage. It's everywhere. I mean, to see a car driving down the street with my other car is a TARDIS, you know, on that bumper sticker in America, it's just become enormous. So it's very exciting.
So that's one legendary sci-fi TV series that we all know and love that you've been on. Let's talk us through Star Trek Deep Space Nine and your appearance there. What can you recollect of your time on the set with Sisko and Co?
Yes, I was aware of that show. I was a fan of that show. I did know that show, and I actually really liked that. So I was hoping that I would get the part. I was really, you know, it would be really neat. And I like all the prosthetics and all the crazy stuff. I thought, oh, this is going to be great if I get it. And I did, and I was thrilled. And it was a complicated role, which I like, a very flawed character. And also, having been an actor my entire life, I mean, every actor probably can say, I'd love to be Peter Pan because you want to fly, right? And so I got to kind of do that. That was the other part. Nothing like, you know, strapping on the harness and
having strings attached to you and flying around the room and kissing a doctor in midair. Come on. Didn't get better than that. So, it was actually an extraordinary experience. Those people lived and breathed, ate, slept that show. Nobody slept. There just wasn't time. Very long hours. And the first time I walked into the hair and makeup trailer, first of all, the smell in there was inexplicable. There was nothing to compare it to.
Unwashed Ferengi.
It was unwashed Ferengi.
Was that the first time you'd worked with prosthetics as an actress?
I don't think so. I think there was another show I did, and the name of it is escaping me. But some kind of a chemical blast had happened, and my face was all mushed up. So I experienced that, but it was really actually, it was like you get it on, you put it on, and there was like I think one scene where I had that all over me. And so it wasn't nearly the experience that I ended up having on Deep Space, because on that one it was like a daily thing. I think I averaged 3 hours of sleep a night, and that was only because I lived 10 minutes away from the studio. So I was lucky. That stuff works on you. I mean, I know Paul, I hate to jump franchises here, but Paul had to wear the wig for the film, and there was a point at which the stuff starts to affect your skin. Yeah. It's really hard on the body. So the Ferengis, whom I've met, by the way, I know those guys. The main guy was like, I couldn't wait to not have to put that on anymore. I think mine was 4.5 hours to get that stuff on.
Oh, gosh.
Theirs was longer. That was even a longer thing. So they learned to sleep, which I never did. Because you get in at 3 a.m. and you're in the chair forever. So, yeah.
You just learn to go to sleep while they're putting it on, basically. Close your eyes and let them do it.
That's right. Well, yeah. I was never able to do that. But it's cool. It was great. And I really had so much respect for everybody on that show, because it was a labor of love in the end. They really drank the Kool-Aid. I loved those guys. Americans will understand what that means. I mean, they really believed
in it. No, we understand that in this country. Any other franchise TV show you'd like to be on but haven't been invited as yet?
Oh, my goodness. Now you're asking me to really think.
Come on, let's get you on Star Trek Discovery or something.
You know what I'd love to be on? I plugged my brother here. Twin Peaks. My brother was on Twin Peaks, and Lynch is cool, right? You never know what he's going to do. So my brother's show is coming back on the 21st of May in the States. I don't know about here. And it's going to start airing again. And I wouldn't mind working with Lynch. And that's a crazy show. So I'll go with that one.
Believe me, we cannot wait for that to come back on, because we absolutely love Twin Peaks, don't we, David?
Absolutely. It's a tremendous show. Tremendous.
It cracks me up. I just watched it back to back, and I'd forgotten how sick David Lynch really is.
Oh,
now.
It's very damaged in places.
Lots of really flawed human beings. Don't we love that?
Absolutely, absolutely. So, thank you, Daphne.
Thank you.
Give Daphne a round of applause, guys.
Stop.
And now we'll have a little bit of Tilted by Christine and the Queens. I am surely good, can't help it if
prophetess and mended souls. Trample over beauty while singing their thoughts. I match them with my euphoria. When they say, je suis plus fort que toi. But I'm actually good. Can't help it if we're tilted. I am actually good. Can't help it if we. I am actually good. Can't help it if we're tilted. I am actually good. Can't help it if we're tilted. Nous et la manne, on est de sortie. Pire qu'une simple moitié, on compte à demi-demi. Pile sur un des bas-côtés comme des origamis. Le bras tendu paraît cassé, tout n'est qu'épié et glié. Bizarre, craché dehors comme par hasard, cachant l'effort dans le griffoir et une creepy song en étendard qui fait. I'm doing my face with a magic marker. I'm in my right place, don't be a doubter. I'm doing my face with a magic marker.
Awesome track, absolutely awesome. Gang, what have you been watching recently? Because we are travelling to Los Angeles in February. We got to see Mrs. Peregrine's school or home for peculiar children, which I thought was fantastic.
That was an amazing film. I mean, it's Tim Burton. I heard that it wasn't very good. People were kind of, oh, it's rubbish. He's lost it. Tim Burton's got no idea. So we watched this film, and it just blew us away, didn't it?
Yeah, we had so little expectation of how good it would be. Mm. But yeah, I just thought it was amazing.
It was so good, really imaginative, nicely put together. A bit Narnia-esque, I thought.
Very.
Because they go through a sort of a portal into this time-locked world.
It's like a cave, though, instead of a wardrobe.
Where the peculiar children live with Miss Peregrine.
And they're basically little mini superheroes. They've all got superpowers. So they have what they call peculiarities, which I just thought was super. It was just something different. Ava Green was the Miss Peregrine. Brilliant performance from her, I have to say. Absolutely superb. Anybody here seen it?
No.
Well, I've seen it. It was like a wartime years...
Yes.
Professor X's home for gifted
children.
Exactly.
It did remind me of the X-Men. It really
I think
did.
It's the first time that Tim Burton has done a cameo in his films as well.
Oh, did he?
He was on the pier at the end in the...
Was he?
Yeah.
I didn't see him. Yeah. But then we were watching on a little tiny aeroplane screen.
Oh, right.
So,
yeah.
We need to get the film on Blu-ray or something.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And, it's definitely a purchase for us.
Yeah.
Definitely.
But we thought it was a lovely, charming little film with such nice performances and nice ideas. And I said to Sam afterwards, I wanted to see more of the children. I wanted more different powers and strangeness and weirdness and stuff.
In fact, it left me wanting more full stop. Yes. I wanted to see more of it, either another film or maybe a series of it.
There is more that you can find. Oh, I haven't read it. It's on my list of things to do.
The novels have actually got manipulated photographs in them as well of the children. I think my mum was reading them and raving about them. And
sounds
she showed
awesome.
Me some. And basically, yeah, in the text, you've got these kind of manipulated black and white photos showing the children demonstrating their powers. They look like they're worth picking up.
So we loved that one. What have you been watching, Robin?
Well, I went back to my roots. The first movie, the first monster movie I ever saw at the tender age of 8 on TV was King Kong.
I thought you were going to say the cinema. You're not that old.
Cinema.
You're not that old. Come on.
I'm older than you. Anyway. Kong, Skull Island.
Hmm.
And I went in. I'd kept away from all spoilers.
What did you So before we go into Kong, Skull Island, what did you think of the first King Kong? The one that...
Are we talking Fay Wray?
Yeah.
No. The first one that Peter Jackson. Thank you. That Peter Jackson had directed.
Loved it.
Right.
I generally don't like remakes. If something's been done well enough the first time, just walk away from it. Otherwise, we're going to be looking at remakes of Gone with the Wind, Casablanca, High Noon, Forbidden Planet. Jaws.
Well, this is what happens, unfortunately. There's no original ideas.
No.
There was also a version with Jack Black as well, wasn't there?
That was the one. That's the Peter Jackson one.
Of course it is. Oh, no, well, yes. What was the one we saw with...
There's the Dina De Laurentiis one.
There's been lots of ones.
Yeah,
oh, I've got an issue with that. I mean, I was 16 years old when that came out, and there was a big publicity poster of Kong standing astride the two towers of the World Trade Center, swatting away at F-16s or whatever they were, and it never appeared in the film. All we got was Rick Baker in a gorilla suit.
Fantastic.
Come on.
People paid good money for that.
I was one of them.
Kong Skull Island.
Yeah.
It will play into a bigger series of films. It's not actually a sequel to King Kong, because there's no reference at all to, you know,
Jack Black,
do you remember in 1933 when that ape fell off again? So they're going in search of a mysterious island shrouded in a storm.
And is this modern day? Is that modern day
1973,
setting?
I believe.
Right, okay.
So it's got an Apocalypse Now feel to it as well.
Mm-hmm.
And they find Kong. Wish they hadn't.
Yeah,
Kong this time is about 300 feet tall. So it's not the sort of larger-than-life ape that, you know, we've seen before. If this monster climbed the Empire State, it would just topple
we'd
over.
Crush it.
Yeah.
And the reason for that is they've already announced that there's going to be a confrontation between Godzilla and Kong.
Again.
Oh.
Well, yeah, it was done in 1963... But this time it's going to be the full-blown CGI, a sequel to the Gareth Edwards film of a couple of years ago.
Right. You know, I'm going to make a comment.
No, I'm sorry. Correct. Unless Godzilla is a Japanese gentleman in a large suit, it's just not going to work. I largely
agree with you on that, once I've collected all those films.
Yeah.
For me, though, I just hate the idea of that. I hated it that when they did it before. I'm not into Godzilla films anyway. I'm not really into creature features, although I do like Kong. So the thought of that is just a bit meh to me.
Oh, I love them. I love, as David just said, Japanese gentlemen stomping around Lego models of Tokyo. How many times have they had to rebuild that city?
That's brilliant. That'd be brilliant.
But you, Daphne, you mentioned to me when you arrived all jet-lagged at our house this week that you've been watching an interesting movie on the plane. What was it you saw?
The Arrival.
Tell us a little bit about that.
I didn't prepare anything, but I will tell you, I really did love that. I did fall asleep, forgive me, but I was up for 12 hours, 12 and a half hours. No, what was it? 10 and a half hours, sorry. But I'm going to go back and watch it because I was absolutely riveted. I was taking notes. I loved it so much. I really did. I thought it was just a great way of looking at the whole aliens visiting the world in a different way. And they took it seriously, and they really went to town on it, and the casts were wonderful. It was really great. So I highly recommend it, even though I don't know how it ends.
But you want to find out how it ends.
I do. I'm going to go get it because I loved it. I just thought it was really well processed. You know, they really didn't take anything for granted. They looked at it from a military perspective. How would the military actually respond to this? How would the scientists respond to this? And how would they pull it all together? And I just thought they did a great job. It was really riveting.
I think that's definitely on our hit list, isn't it? Anybody else here seen it?
No, I saw it in the cinema.
You've seen it?
Yeah.
And you would agree?
I agree.
Don't tell me how it is.
No spoilers. I think
the whole earth explodes.
So, Kong Skull Island, the arrival's on my hit list. And I think we're now going to hear Cry For You by September.
Hey! life. Forever's gonna slow you down.
You'll never see me again.
Are you interested in video games? If so, be sure to join me, Jake, on the Cyber Den, your weekly dose of tech and games. Treat yourself to the latest news, interviews, some brilliant music, and much more. After all, it is approved by...
me, Duke Nukem.
Kane from Command and Conquer.
Agent 47.
Colonel Roy Campbell.
And more. So join me, Jake, on the Cyber Den every Wednesday, 10 till 12.
On Siren FM 107.3.
Don't want to miss a show?
You can listen to Siren FM wherever you are.
On your smartphone or tablet. Just download the Radio Player app for iPhone, iPad or Android.
Just search for Siren FM.
You can listen live, get in touch or catch up on podcasts. So,
on 107.3 FM.
On tablets.
On sirenonline.co.uk.
Or your mobile phone. However you listen,
tune in to Siren FM.
Hi, this is Chase Masterson, and you're listening to Sam Stone and Friends with the Stone Tapes on Siren FM.
And we're over now to the man factor. Yes, it's that time again. George.
The man factor.
What have you been looking at to talk to us about this time?
So I've been working my socks off in the last month, and the only thing that's really kept me sane has been binge-watching Black Sails on Amazon Prime, the streaming service.
Other streaming services are available. Streaming services.
Yeah. But I love the fact I can just log on and watch another episode, and then actually, if I'm still up for it, keep going. And Black Sails has been one of those shows where I've wanted to keep going constantly. If you don't know what it is, it's a pirate story, really. And it's actually a prequel to Treasure Island, although you'd never be able to tell, really, unless you... kind of, you know, the threads, because it's played very very dark, very brutal, very realistic, and it's a fabulously evolving series. I've seen the first two series of four, and it's a finite story because it's going to take people up to the Treasure Island. It's set around the pirate port of Nassau in the early 18th century, and it's just so fabulously written. It's got a very novelistic structure to the way it's done. I was just talking to Daphne off air about it, and how they've clearly planned out in detail everything that's going to happen in the whole four seasons, because the payoffs that come like 20 episodes in to things that happened in the first series.
Wow.
It's got brilliant actors. Captain Flint is played by Toby Stevens, and he's just such a rich, complex character. He really brings himself. He's a fallen British naval officer who's become this embittered pirate, and he's on the search for the Urca gold. The Urca is a Spanish treasure ship laden with gold, and he wants this treasure. And for the first season, you really think he wants this treasure to buy his way out of his pirate situation. You know, he doesn't want to be a pirate, really. And actually, as the second series goes on, you start to see the politics and the romance and the love story that's behind it all, and you find out what's driving him, and you realise actually that there's a lot more to it. The reason he wants this gold isn't actually that personal. He's on a personal quest, but he wants to end piracy in general in the region. He wants to kind of bring a better life to people. But he goes about it in such a vicious way. I mean, you know, anyone who gets in his way in pursuit of that goal, including his first mate, who's this fabulous character throughout the whole first series, he'll knife him in the back, you know, quite literally, if he needs to get to where he needs to be. And it's looking at kind of the love story is looking at homosexuality in the second series as well, and it's just so well done. It's, you know, in a time in the early 18th century when it's you couldn't be openly homosexual. It's got two story threads and exploring the theme. And there's lots of real pirates in there, people like Anne Bonny, mixed in with John Silver, who's in the cast as well. And he starts off kind of he's a bit of a cheeky chappy, played by Luke Arnold, and he realises he's got a real talent for manipulating people and getting people on side. And he becomes this ally of Captain Flint. And in series two, we've just seen him lose his leg, so we know he's going to become.
Does he get longer as he goes on?
He has a very long memory.
He does.
Is that what it is?
And you've got little hints. You know, there's Billy Bones, who at the start of the Treasure Island, if you know the novel, the start of Treasure Island, he's the old pirate who dies. He's talking to Long and Silver, but he's a young man in this story.
Wow.
And it's again, they've plotted it so carefully.
Yep. It's extraordinary. I am a huge fan of this show. I think the guy, I wish I could think of his name, and maybe you have it there, Jack Rackham.
Oh, I don't have his name here.
He is absolutely extraordinary. But everybody is, but he is fabulous. And how about his mate? Anne.
Anne Bonny, yeah.
Unbelievable acting. Mm-hmm. And then there's the French whore.
Yeah.
Who is extraordinary. She's Canadian, whoever she is. She's brilliant.
She's a master at plotting and like behind the scenes, she's running everything, isn't she? Really.
Some of her dialogue, has actually brought me to openly weeping aloud. It's extraordinary.
The writing is the writing and the acting, they're just both superb.
And on that note, I think it's time for something else that's epic. Lindsay Gold, storyteller.
Quick-witted Sinbad and other details. I'll spin you half a story each night. I won't bow before your rage and might. I'm a storyteller, spreading words.
Ah,
David, tell us about your film of the month.
Well, from storyteller to one of the best stories, I think, that Hammer ever told. And this month, our film of the month is Captain Kronos, Vampire Hunter. And I expect an ooh, ooh from the audience. So this has long been one of my favourite Vampire and Hammer films. It's a tremendous film. 72 on the video, and it says 74 in IMDb. What the devil does that mean?
Go for 73.
we'll assume it's 1973. So Captain Kronos, Vampire Hunter. It's a brilliant vampire take, written and produced and directed by Brian Clemens, who, of course, brought us The Avengers and all of those kind of great action series from ATV and so on in the 60s, like The Baron and The Persuaders and all that kind of stuff. And I think that was kind of part of the problem, in that it brought this new sensibility to Hammer films. It's got a slightly different flavour to it, to all of the other films. It's got a tremendous cast. Horst Janssen plays the title role of Captain Kronos. It's got John Carson, Shane Bryant, Caroline Munro in probably her biggest role for Hammer. It's just tremendous. It's got the look of Hammer and the kind of the plot of like a very quirky vampire-ridden episode of The Avengers with a tremendous cast. And it's relatively simple. The idea here is that the vampires don't just take your blood, they take your youth and your vitality. And so when you get attacked by the vampires, you age really quickly. And the film starts with these nice, pretty young girls kind of aging really quickly. And it's actually really well shot and beautifully done. And because of these strange deaths, and Dr. Marcus, who's John Carson, calls in Captain Kronos and his hunchback Hieronymus Grost, who are professional vampire hunters. And I love that idea that you could be a professional vampire hunter. I think that's tremendous. So they come along to try and work out what the devil's going on here. There's lots of red herrings along the way. There's people who might be the vampires or not be the vampires. And the film kind of progresses. They rescue Caroline Munro from the stocks and sort of take her along with her, because she obviously fancies Horst Janssen, and with trousers that tight, exceptionally tight trousers.
He is a thing of beauty.
You know, these were tight trousers before David Bowie wore them in Labyrinth. You know, yes. we're talking that tight.
Well, the costuming went with sort of a Regency feel.
It did, yes.
I think that was because of the tight trousers that were popular in the Regency era.
It was tremendous. It's a tremendous film. We meet various other people. Lady Durwood, who's beautifully played by... Whose name's gone from
Wanda
me?
Wanda Ventham.
I've got the list here. Thank you. I'll turn it over.
Benedict Cumberbatch's
mother.
Really?
Is
yes.
Who Wanda Ventham is.
Yes, she is.
She looks just like him.
Ian Hendry does a wonderful turn as a villain called Kero in the pub. And he's wonderfully sarcastic and beautifully played. And, of course, it has to have Michael Ripper in as well.
Every Hammer film has
to have Michael Ripper in. So I absolutely love this film. I'll throw it open to the panel now, because I think this is tremendous. So, Sam, you've loved this film for forever as well.
I do love this. This is absolutely, and I know everybody's got a different view on it, but it's one of my ultimate favourite Hammers. And I think it is because it has a different feel to the others. I feel like it's not as corny, and it isn't quite as familiar as the other Hammers, as much as I love those. And I did feel like it was gearing things up a bit and trying to bring Hammer into a new era, which we believe Hammer didn't really enjoy at that time. Oh. They didn't want to be dragged kicking and screaming into a new era. But I think it's a wonderful film in itself.
I really liked how it kept me guessing. I look at the first 5 minutes and go, oh, that person is the vampire. And I wasn't able to do that with this film. Mm. And I really liked that.
I like that, too.
I loved the fact that, I mean, I'm sort of a nerd for eras. And maybe that's because I'm an actor or something. But I really like those snapshots that give you the style of the day, both in the acting and the writing, but also in the costumes and the hair and makeup and stuff. I really dig that. So that's part of the reason why I love old black and white films, because it feels like I'm getting a window into that period. So I really enjoyed that part of it, and I really thought it stood up. I mean, it really they did a really, really fine job at getting it done, and it was really cool to see.
Had a good plot. The plot was really good. It really is.
And it was nice to look at Benedict's mother, because they actually do look a lot alike.
Eyes, definitely the eyes.
Well, I think it was the last classic Hammer film. After that, the only vampire film they made was Legend of the Seven Golden Vampires.
Yes, that one as well.
It was a horrible attempt to fuse Kung Fu and vampires.
Can't beat it.
With Peter Cushing looking like he'd wandered on to the wrong
is
set.
Is that the one with the hopping vampires?
Yes.
I thought it was hilarious.
But this, I spoke to Caroline Munro a while back, and she was telling me that it was actually meant to be the beginning of a new series that the character would have carried on.
Ah.
Now, I loved this because it was dispensing with the usual vampire tropes. When they're trying to find out exactly what will kill Dr. Marcus, it was being stabbed with the cross.
Yes.
Sadly, Hammer themselves ran out of money.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why pretty much they wound up production, because they had to basically beg, borrow, sell the ranch just in order to make Legend of the Seven Golden Vampires. And that came out just after the Kung Fu craze around the time of Bruce Lee's death. And it finally destroyed them. There was only
To
the Devil
a
Daughter
series.
After that, I think.
It's continuing as a comic, actually. They've announced this week that there's going to be a comic series.
Well, actually, it did in Des Skin's House of Hammer for about 16 issues.
But it's coming back for a brand new series.
Dan Abnett's right.
Yeah, that's right,
So what did you make of the film?
I'm the only voice of dissent here. I only watched it for the first time yesterday. And it's shocking. And the thing, I don't know if I went into it with too high expectation, but I love the Avengers, and I adore Hammer films. So I went into this expecting it to be fabulous, and it just left me a bit cold. I'll be honest. I felt the anachronisms didn't work for me in the way that they do in the Avengers. I felt it was in need of a plot.
Oh, really?
You guys saying that.
I think it has a great plot.
No, and you guys saying you think it's good. And I just wonder if I just didn't.
Did you watch the same film?
I know.
Fiona was the same, George,
she just couldn't click with it.
It honestly could be one of those films that it could be a Marmite film for some people, you know.
Yeah.
I think a lot of films are anyway. And you know, not every Hammer movie, I don't like certain ones as well. My favourites is this one, Dr. Jekyll and Sister Hyde. And probably Vampire Circus would come in third after that. But Twins of Evil's another one, you know. But there's certain ones I love more than others. And some of them I think, that was really corny and I didn't really like that.
But an interesting fact about it that we actually found out the other day, but it is actually in IMDb as well, is that Horst Janssen's voice was dubbed for the whole film.
Oh, really? For the whole film?
And it was dubbed by Julian Holloway, who was in Survival, the Doctor Who story, which is really surreal, bizarre, weird fact of the day, people.
Wow.
But they dubbed him with a Germanic accent, which is what he had anyway.
Very bizarre. Yeah.
So it's very peculiar that they would actually...
It was very good, though. You can't tell.
You can't really
I never
tell.
Thought it was the
I
case.
I would never have noticed that.
But I'm afraid, guys, this is it. That's all we've got time for. So a huge thanks to David J. Hamm, Patricia H. Ash, Robin Pierce, George Mann, our special guest, Daphne Ashbrook, and especially our producer, Alex Lefchuk, and Ryan Jones and Ed Wellman from Siren FM for their technical wizardry, and of course, for the first time, our audience. Give yourselves a round of applause.